Hello, and thank you for joining the Connection Therapy Podcast. This is a podcast about the craft of psychotherapy, and we seek to support those who strive to improve their craft by sharing research about the science and stories about the art of psychology. Together, we will explore these findings so you can decide how you want to apply them to benefit your practice. In a lot of psychotherapy, the interventions are centered around cognitions. In other words, the idea that one's thoughts are fundamentally the driver of actions or behaviors, and that if cognitions can be supported, then psychological suffering will reduce. The problem with this is most practicing clinicians have found that the feelings about something are likewise central to someone's actions and behaviors. And so there is this long-standing discussion about which drives which. That is, do thoughts drive feelings, or do feelings drive thoughts? The implications are significant because, as the study that I'm going to discuss today points out, the current paradigm has driven mental health support for 4 decades. That is to say, the interventions and the systems around how mental health support is done is significantly driven by this current paradigm. And you guessed it, the authors are going to suggest that we go back in history where they'll explain to us how things went awry. And they're going to bring up some other theorists whose ideas were not mainstreamed at the time, but whose theories are now being displayed by neuroscience research. And in case it's not obvious, they're going to suggest that it is the affects, or what could be understood as emotions, that are the primary driver. So let's see what implications this has for the practice of psychotherapy. The title of the article is Primary Appraisal is Affective, Not Cognitive, Exploring a Revised Transactional Model of Stress and Coping. Authors are Stefan and Anderson. It was published this year in 2025 in the Journal of Applied Psychophysiology and Biofeedback. So first they introduce the transactional model of stress and coping by Lazarus and Folkman from the 1980s. And they're going to suggest that its focus on cognition as the primary appraisal system, in other words, how decisions get made are by thoughts, that is inaccurate. And then they're going to list a lot of current neuroscience research that demonstrates that it's actually affect or emotional processes that drive decisions, and then cognition follows suit. And this might sound familiar, where affect as a primary system, because I've reviewed it quite a bit on the podcast in the sense of Jaak Panksepp's work. And in fact, this article is tremendous confirmation for Panksepp's ideas of the affective systems, those 7 affective systems, which are seeking, rage, fear, care, lust, panic and grief as one, and play and joy as the 7th. So again, seeking, rage, fear, care, lust, panic, grief, and play, joy. Those are Panksepp's original ideas, and this article doesn't list out Panksepp's systems. In fact, they don't reference Panksepp's work, but for me, the affects that they're talking about rest very squarely within Panksepp's work, and I think they're an easier way to understand affect overall if we consider that as mammals, we are part of Panksepp's theories, and that those primary processes, those primary affects are internal to us all. And these authors do suggest, though, a long history of theorists and philosophers, and they go all the way back to the Greeks to discuss different ways that humans have tried to make sense of our experiences on the planet ever since that time, and probably before then, but that's kind of what we have record back to that far. And they do a beautiful job of discussing how Socrates and Plato's original theories contributed significantly to our current paradigm. And they point out that Aristotle was unique in a way that he had similar thinking, but also made a lot more room for affect in his work. And then they go into the line of philosophers that leads to Descartes, who was a French philosopher and scientist that is responsible for quotes such as, "I think, therefore I am," and in the 1600s conceived of a split between mind and body, at least that's how it's commonly discussed today. And this moment is considered widely as the moment that influences a lot of what's called Western thinking about how we make sense of our environments and respond accordingly. And they present a wide variety of theorists and philosophers who contest Descartes' assertions. And I'm going to highlight just two, Immanuel Kant and Martin Heidegger, which both happen to be German philosophers. Kant was writing in the 1700s, and these authors, Stefan and Anderson, summarize, quote, "For Kant, since all conscious perception and understanding is mediated by the subject's physical body, all actual experience is inescapably subjective, and no mind can have unmediated objective access to the material realm." So as I understand what they're saying here, that summarizes what Kant said, is that we can't get out of our bodies. And so to this idea that we could have some objectivity about the world as distinct from our own views of it and our own experiences and the context within which we're looking at the world is just a fallacy. There's no way that we could get out of ourselves enough to have an objective view of the world. And as such, everything we know or think we know about the world is mediated or affected by our experience of it. And it sounds maybe totally obvious, but it has a lot of implications when we're thinking about things like, you know, what is truth? What is fact? Because all of these things, as much as we try to be objective, are context dependent in the way that we assess them. And so that's why, from my own perspective, that we work together to establish larger discussions like that. But for purposes of psychotherapy, for me, this is why the truth of something in that what happens to a patient or their experiences, the truth of it is sort of irrelevant. I'm most interested in their experience of it and not necessarily some version of truth that's kind of worked out by a variety of others. When I'm working in psychotherapy, then the person's experience is paramount. And that's why Kant's ideas really resonate with me. And he also suggested, as the authors summarize, that affect is the primary appraisal. And in other words, feelings drive thoughts. And they go on to explain that Kant's consideration is that we are active participants, quote, in creating the environment we inhabit, and that we then represent this environment to ourselves. And there again is this idea that we can't get out of our environment to look at it objectively. We can only see it from the eyes we are looking with inside the environment that we're trying to assess. And And then they go on to review Martin Heidegger's work, and he wrote in the early 1900s. He takes this a step further, and he's known for his work on phenomenology and existentialism and hermeneutics, which are words to say very similar things, that there's this experience of being in the world that we are positioned to think from our experience of being in the world, and we cannot not do that. It's kind of a lot of words to say what is probably very straightforward if we consider things. It's just that so much of our knowledge tends to be built on this idea or hope that there is some, you know, natural world out there that we could just understand or learn about. And these two philosophers are reminding us that that may be true, but we will never be able to fully see it with objectivity. It'll always be from our subjective experiences. And the authors summarize more of Heidegger's work here, which I found really beautiful. And they suggest that his contributions include the fact that human existence is constitutionally authentic and intersubjective. And what they're talking about there is, quote, "In its most basic form, it cannot be the product of any single embodied mind, since the development of language as a system of meaningful and communicable symbols require multiple subjects. Therefore, language is a social phenomenon." So here we are again, now having to grapple with the fact that there is perhaps an objective world somewhere, but we have to see it with our own subjectivity. And the people with whom we share this world with are in the same predicament. So now, as a group or a culture, we're coming up with language being a socially constructed phenomena. And again, you know, you think about it, it's quite obvious that groups of humans come up with different languages, and that's how the world is populated, with a variety of many languages. And yet, to consider how much that then is used to interpret and inform our experiences was a significant part of Heidegger's contributions. So what does this mean for psychotherapy? Well, the authors suggest multiple implications that center around the idea that this being in the world causes us to have an effective attunement to our environment that needs to be heavily emphasized in psychological interventions. In fact, much more so they're calling for than it is today. And I would like to summarize this from a practicing clinician standpoint and suggest that therapeutically, what this indicates for me is that what I do in practice, I will continue to do, which is I really refrain from asking someone what they were thinking when something happened, for example. I have a lot of experience in training early on, especially in working with survivors of trauma and abuse, including children. And what I have learned in my work is that to ask someone what they were thinking actually kind of stuns them for a minute, because, and I get, when I have done that on occasion, which is one reason I don't do it anymore, it kind of stops someone in their tracks as they're recounting a particular experience, because a lot of times they weren't thinking, and that's because trauma interferes with cognition and the cognitive capacities, because most everything that's happening in our bodies is intended to support our survival. And so when someone is under threat, our bodies switch over to the active parts of our system so that we can respond to the threat. And thinking is, of course, part of that, but thinking at that point is not considering how to make a decision, but making quick appraisals. And that's where Panksepp and others have demonstrated very clearly that for mammals, we go into our limbic system typically to make those assessments and then react. And I found that to be true when I practice. And that's why a lot of times when I'm supporting someone in working through, you know, things that have happened with them or working through current day experiences that are affected by things that have happened in their past, I sometimes don't even use words. I just listen. In fact, for me, a marker of good therapy is when I speak very little and instead listen while the person makes sense of what happened. And on occasion, when it's difficult for them to verbalize things, I do ask sometimes about how they were feeling, but a lot of times I encourage their awareness of the environment, smells, temperatures, things they noticed as they're recounting the story of whatever they're discussing that day in therapy. And I find this to be helpful because for someone in a traumatized state, it's often a grouping or a series of small images or senses that are sort of all together, and they need support to help bring them forth in order to make sense of them. And so essentially, in my interventions, it's more of a encouragement of all of the human capacities, feelings, behaviors, cognitions. They're all welcome in my work, but I definitely wait to ask about cognitions. And for me, there's a way that you can sense when someone's calmed down enough to be able to talk about thoughts over feelings and over the comments about the environment, such as smells or things they noticed. It's an interesting way that they start to make more eye contact, their voice prosody gets more rhythmic, and then I know that we can talk about cognitions. But I almost never do that in the beginning of someone explaining a story because I want to follow their lead and learn from them what was most important and what needs to be shared, and then together we can kind of make sense as is needed to be. And so to me, this article sums up so many important implications for therapy that are along the lines of the ones I'm discussing. And I'm excited about it because I've seen for a while now that many of us practice in this way already, and we're kind of waiting for research and interventions to catch up. And if you're one of those therapists, then this article is hopefully encouraging to you that some researchers are leaning in this direction. In fact, many researchers are. I'll continue to present some articles in this arena. And as I mentioned, this article is in the Journal of Applied Psychophysiology and Biofeedback. And as I was reading it, I thought how unique it is to find such a theoretical, persuasive article in a journal such as this that focuses on biofeedback. And while I'm not sure, I have a guess that this might be because biofeedback may end up being one of the more objective arbiters on what really works. That is, what really is evidence-based therapy. Biofeedback measurements are fairly neutral in their assessment, not assessing how someone self-reports how effective treatment was, but instead, biofeedback measures what, if any, physiological indicators have changed as a result of therapy. And for myself, this makes me kind of intrigued and excited about the advent of biofeedback as part of the field of psychotherapy. It just seems that more information about the full human is really relevant here, and I'm excited to see how these things continue to take shape in the future. I hope you'll join us again for future explorations in the field of psychology. And if you'd like to take a step further, there are additional ways to obtain more education and support on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. While there, you will find information about the authors and studies featured in the podcast episodes. Also, you will see a schedule of live trainings I offer on the topics featured in the podcast. And you will find information about the Connection Community, a growing group of mental health clinicians dedicated to the study and practice of psychotherapy. Please check out our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com, to learn more. Thanks. Until next time.